the proposal, but members of the Palestinian Authority appear on board as well. With the envelopment of Gaza nearly complete, Hamas has very few alternatives left. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
This is a simple song. This is a simple song about simple things. A simple song about simple things. A simple song about simple things. A child is killed. A child is killed. A child is killed. So many killed. This is a simple song. A simple song. A simple song about simple things. Who was that child? What was their story? What would they say? They were here today. This is a simple song. A simple song. This is a simple song about simple things. They took our land and then they occupied us. And when we fought, they called us terrorists. This is a simple song. Simple song. And then they segregated all our people. There were roads for them, but not for us. One law for them, one for us. And then the walls, so many walls. And then the walls, so many walls. This is a simple song. A simple song. A simple song about simple things. And then their prisons were filled with fathers. Their prisons. Their prisons filled with half our men and with children and a woman. What would you do? Where would you go? What would you do? Where would you go? This is a simple song. A simple song. A simple song about simple things. Our mothers wrote our names on our arms. Each one of us was born for the family land. Because most of us, so many of us, yeah, most of us, so many would die before our time. This is a simple song. A simple song. A simple song about simple things. And all your politicians, politicians,
orphan does for money and the sale of arms. This is a simple song. It is not complicated. It is a simple song. And when they said never again, and when they said never again, it was not for us. This is a simple song. A simple song. This is a simple song. If you want peace, give me justice. End the occupation. Share the land. One love for all of us. No more wars. This is a simple song. That child, but for the grace of God, is you.
Simple song by Khaled Abdullah, the actor and singer, that tells it all. Right now, the whole world is watching as the flotilla, as the boats approach Gaza. And on a split screen, I'm watching these live broadcasts from the boats, as they are less than 100 nautical miles from Gaza. And as they're being surrounded right now by naval boats, Israeli naval boats, that intend to intercept them. We don't know what's happening, but I do want to address one issue. And by the way, this is Zain al-Amin with the Shai Nana Show. I wanted to address an issue that there are people who are saying awful things about the flotilla, basically in chorus with the Hasbara, the propaganda that Israel is passing about these people, that they are selfish in their attempt. These people should be shut out. I don't care what nationality you are. If you're saying that at this moment, especially if you're picking this moment to criticize the flotilla, you are complicit in any kind of danger that you that. This flotilla is going to be exposed to. These people, and I know personally a handful of them that are on these boats, these people have been fighting for Palestinian liberation way before October 7th, way before the starvation. They knew that this moment was coming. So for those who use their nationality or say that I'm Palestinian and therefore I can criticize, for every Palestinian that criticizes the flotilla, I'll raise you five other Palestinians that will shut you down. The purpose of this flotilla is to open a humanitarian corridor because nations refuse to do it. And what they're doing, there are 44 countries represented on these boats, and they're trying to pressure those 44 countries to act because they haven't acted. Even Italy had to pretend that it's acting, the government of Italy, because the Italians rose up And by the way, this is not just about establishing a humanitarian corridor. It's also going to spark a shutdown of all ports in Europe for weaponry going to Israel. Because as we mentioned at the last show, and it's been mentioned all week, Genoan dock workers, and I'll be in Genoa next month, Genoan dock workers have told the world that, and especially Israel and the United States, that even if they lose contact with the ships for even 20 minutes, that they'll shut down Europe. That's their exact words. We will shut down Europe. So this is also meant to spark the labor to fight back. Of course, in the U.S., we have a very, you know, an anemic labor force here. Not the force, but the organizers that are in their ivory towers and are in bed with the Democratic Party. And maybe this will give them a nudge here. This is also meant to spark that powder keg called labor, right? Workers of the world, right? To act and to shut down everything. And that's where we are right now. These boats are in the danger zone. These boats are filled with principled people who are not just sharing images of themselves, but also alternating with images of Gaza and asking us to keep our eyes on Gaza as it's going through even a more horrific phase right now. And we have a segment later that will really catalog how horrific is this segment or is this phase of history when it comes to Gaza, when it comes to humanity, the history of humanity. What we're seeing is on par with what the Nazis did to the Jews. What Israel is doing, what Zionists are doing, Zionists in Israel are the new Nazis, are the Nazis of the 21st century. And we are seeing this late response, you know, as Omar al-Aqad said, you know, one day everyone would have always been against this, you know, of course. We're seeing these people step out of the darkness to say, oh, we've always been against this, because they're seeing things like decapitated pregnant women giving birth in hospitals. Just when you see, when you hear about one atrocity and you think that is the worst, another atrocity is presented to you that's beyond imagination, that is so awful and so brutal and so inhumane that you question your own sanity. And that's what it meant to do. You have to question your own sanity. And speaking of sanity, of course, we have an insane president who delivered, along with Hegseth, the Secretary of War, the most drug-addled, and I'm sure Hegseth was on some sort of drug. His mental capacity is degrading, and as it degrades, he's hopped up on something. Of course, his ego is growing, and he thinks he's General Patton now, that he can stand in front of this large American flag, just like in the movie General Patton, and pace back and forth and make fun of his own forces, his own military forces. And this goes against that, you know, there's a principle, and I don't support, of course, militarization of any form, but there is a principle even within the military that you praise in public and you condemn in private, or criticize in private when it comes to the military, if you're part of the military. He did the opposite. He criticized in public, and criticize is a soft word to what he did, what Hegseth did. And you could see that was, you know, followed by the morose president of the United States of America. It's incredible that, you know, he's Exhibit A when we say the empire is failing. Those who questioned us say, ah, that's what you meant. So we have this morose guy whose face is melting as he proceeds, he enters the room after Hegseth's crazy speech that's now being criticized by ex-military folks that are in the upper echelons of the that were in the upper echelons of the military, saying, what was that about? When by the time Hegseth finished, by the way, the whole room was shut down. Like there, you can hear a pin drop after Hegseth's speech, and that's because people were shocked. They couldn't believe these generals that were brought in from all over the world were in shock that they were brought in for this dressing down by Hegseth, who is, you know, a virtual warrior whose major wounds have been paper cuts when he was shuffling paper in the military. So that's the state we're in right now. And we'll talk more about it later. But for now, I wanted to just bring forward Greta Thunberg's message, a short message that she put out this morning. The environmentalist activist, the environmentalist from Sweden, talking about what this flotilla is about, and that is not the end of all things; it's the beginning, and it's part of the flotillas that came before it and the flotillas that will come after it. So let's hear what Greta has to say about this.
Mission is not at all a one-time mission. It is not at all something that we do gather to do and then let go. This is the 38th attempt to break Israel's illegal siege on Gaza. These missions have been continuing since 2008, continuously sending boats to try to break the siege. For me personally, this is my third attempt, and we'll keep fighting until we achieve the goal. And also, it is very, very important to note that while this is a humanitarian mission, it is not at all just about delivering humanitarian aid and then leaving. What we aim to do is to break the siege and establish a humanitarian corridor where we can continue to bring in aid. The problem is not just to get food into Gaza. The blockade and the siege is the problem. That is what we are trying to challenge while peacefully sailing on international waters, abiding by international law. We need an end to the apartheid state. We need an end to the occupation and the oppression that Palestinians have been living under for many, many decades. So we are trying to challenge this extremely violent system that is unable to even prevent the worst war crimes from happening. The UN Commission has confirmed that it is now a genocide after countless of Palestinians and human rights organizations have been saying that for a long time. And that means that under international law, states have a legal obligation to act to stop the genocide from happening. That means that they have to end arms transfers, end their complicity, and apply real pressure. So that is what we expect from our governments. Unfortunately, they are failing to do even the bare minimum. And that is why we are doing this mission as a last resort. But this mission should not have to exist. So the work continues. This movement, this mission is only a part of a large global uprising of people saying enough is enough. People are tired of the hypocrisy because we are not falling for Israel's recycled lies and smear campaigns.
So that was Greta telling it like it is, And for those of you naysayers, this framing should hopefully wake you up from your critique and endangering this mission by spouting off sectarian things about what and speaking on behalf of the Gazans, which for every Gazan you tell me that I've never heard of everything I've seen. I've seen the people of Gaza waiting for these boats, hoping against hope that they will reach the shores, writing messages on the shores of Gaza, welcoming children, reciting songs and poetry and welcoming them. That's the reality. And I urge you to stand in solidarity and to be watchful and to also pressure your governments, pressure your people to like we can act here. We can act in Baltimore in solidarity. If these Genoan dock workers shut down Europe, they had met with dock workers from all over Europe, so this wasn't empty talk. If they shut down, we need to shut down the ports at Baltimore. In Baltimore, they receive so many weapons that so many weapons pass through that are killing children and women and men in Palestine. Also on the West Coast in Oakland, dock workers before had shut down the port in cases like this. They've shut down the port with previous attacks on Gaza, which, by the way, happened before October 7. Guess what? History didn't start with October 7. So we need international solidarity. If you're connected with the folks in Baltimore, if you're connected with people, if you know people on the West Coast, we need to get to these dock workers and also and shut down the ports there. If the Italians manage to link up Europe and shut down those ports and stop these shipments of murder and mayhem. Speaking of murder and mayhem, this is an interview that Breaking Points did with a doctor that was banned from Gaza, and he tells you what the conditions were, and just brace yourself for what he's about to say. He has been banned from coming back to Palestine, and he's one of the most important people in reporting on it. This tells you what's at stake right now. And even if you have not acted before, I urge you, it's not too late. It's never too late to act. You need to act. And there are fissures happening among our representatives, thankfully, where more and more, like the recent Lieutenant Governor of Michigan, saying that he will not take AIPAC money. He is about to run as for the governor of Michigan, and he's announcing in his campaign that for his campaign as governor of Michigan, he will not take any AIPAC money. These kind of breakdowns are happening, and people like Schumer and Jeffries are being exposed for the puppets that they are, for their Israel first, for not supporting to this day, for not supporting Zohran, who is the Democratic winner of the primary in New York. Not supporting him. Why? Because, as I put it, the AIPAC got their tongue. can you say genocide, or did the AIPAC get your tongue? That's what I've been telling the Jeffries of the world. These people, Schumer and Jeffries and Torres, are on par with the Trumps and the Hexeth of the world. They are no greater or less evil. They're just as evil. In fact, they're less even principled. These other people are principled in their brutality. These people are just after money. That's it. Their AIPAC has got them, and they don't care how much AIPAC is funding in terms of massacres in Israel. Schumer doesn't care, and Jeffries doesn't care, and Tories, who leads the who are will be beating at, in every episode, beating him about the head, of course virtually, who leads the poorest area of New York, the poorest borough of New York, can't even solve a single problem in his own borough, but he can take $1,200,000 from AIPAC and shut up about murder and mayhem that Israel is doing. So with that, let's listen to this doctor that was banned from Gaza as he's being interviewed on Breaking Points.
Really happy to be joined this morning by one of the most extraordinary human beings I have ever had the pleasure of meeting, Dr. Mohammed Mustafa, who, among other things, is an ER doctor, traveled to Gaza multiple times post-October 7th, treated patients there, but also former professional rugby player, Palestinian refugee, all sorts of titles we could give you. But yeah, it's great to meet you in person, Dr. Mo.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a bit overwhelmed actually being here because I've watched this so often.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, so it's
that's an
crazy
honor.
Being
Thank
in the
you.
Studio,
that
yeah.
Does it look how you expected?
Do you know, I always, because, you know, when you see it on TV, you think, well, this is going to be like a big operation, but you guys have, it's compact.
We
and
keep
it's,
it tight, yeah. Yeah, yeah, we're not wasting any space.
I like it. I love it, though. I love it. You pack a punch.
Yeah.
So you're in the U.S., by the way, guys, he lives in Australia. You're in the U.S. in the context of the U.N. meetings that are going mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. Give us any updates about, you know, who you spoke with and progress that has been made in your advocacy.
Well, I mean, you know, you can see the situation in Gaza is becoming more and more catastrophic. And while everyone keeps focusing on recognition of Palestine, which, you know, in itself, there's so many problems with just recognizing a state of Palestine, because they're recognizing the state of Palestine with all these conditions that have to be met. But the recognition doesn't come with justice, and the recognition doesn't come with any form of plan for what we do about the disastrous humanitarian crisis going on in Gaza. And what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to get politicians, one, to understand the gravity of the situation in Gaza. You know, we have 1 million children who are being starved to death. Quarter of the population are at stage 5 famine, which means that 4 out of every 10,000 children die a day at stage 5 famine, mm-hmm. 2 out of every 10,000 adults. When you reach stage 5 famine, food isn't enough, because if you give people food at that stage, they could get things like refeeding syndrome, mm-hmm. and that could cause arrhythmias and heart attacks, and it could kill them. So you don't just need an increase in aid, you need an increase of medical workforce. You need a reconstruction of infrastructure that stops things like communicable diseases that are spreading now in Gaza. And politicians are so, you know, concerned with recognizing a Palestinian state and not upsetting the United States that they completely have lost focus on the real humanitarian mm-hmm. situation in Gaza. And, you know, we've been speaking to politicians, whether it's been the Irish delegation, whether it was the Foreign Minister of Australia, and I'm in contact with British politicians as well, to try and get them and urge them to really push forward with this hospital, bringing a hospital into Gaza, bringing an influx of healthcare professionals. But unfortunately, it's not very easy to mm-hmm. convince them to do this, because I think a lot of them feel that recognizing a Palestinian state is enough for now.
And 2 years of covering this has this extraordinarily dark situation has sent my mind to some pretty dark places. Mm-hmm. And hearing you talk about the effects of famine on the bottom and on the body and phase 5's famine, it makes me wonder what the long-term effects for people who survive are on fertility, both for men and women. Because Israel clearly has no solution for where to send.
Yeah.
They want everybody out, but the countries resist taking half a dozen medical evacuations.
Yeah.
You're really going to have a hard time finding a place for 2 million people.
Yeah.
But if mortality continues to expand mm-hmm. and fertility collapses, mm-hmm. then maybe in 30 years the long-term solution is, well, there's just nobody left anymore.
Yeah.
What are the effects of malnutrition to that degree on the body's ability to reproduce?
I mean, there's a number of things. One, first of all, is stunted growth. A lot of these children will have stunted growth, and that will affect them for the rest of their mm-hmm. lives. Pregnant women are not receiving the right kind of nutrients. So the development of the fetus in the womb doesn't have the nutrients to develop its neural pathways. So you're going to find a lot of children are going to be born with, you know, neurodivergent symptoms. You're going to find a lot of them that are going to be born with developmental delays and issues. You've also got, when you reach that level stage of famine, it actually, the trauma of it and the stress of it actually changes the DNA of an individual. So that's going to be passed down. We are talking about, and as well, you know, look, there's been no vaccination program for 2 years. There has been no schooling for 2 years. We've not just lost what's been reported, which is 20,000 children deaths, which, by the way, is astronomically higher than 20,000. We're talking about a million children who are now losing their education, who have, who probably all of them, 95% of them have some form of PTSD and psychological delay. You have the largest cohort of child amputees in the world. You have the largest cohort of orphans per capita in the world. And there's no solution to this. You know, when we talk about where do these people go, or who's going to take them, if you're taking in these Palestinian refugees, you're going to be taking on a very, very traumatized population that are going to need lifelong medical care for the rest of their lives. And this is what I'm trying to stress to these politicians, that simply just having a few evacuations is not enough. Simply just recognizing a Palestinian state is enough. And this idea of just sending them to Sudan, South Sudan, or Libya, or these war-torn places, means that, like you say, this population will die out over time, because the amount of health problems that they're going to have when they develop metabolic conditions because of because of the starvation, they're going to have insulin problems. All of this because of the starvation, it means that this population is going to be a very unhealthy population, both physically and mentally.
Dr. Mo, could you speak to what the medical system in Gaza was like the two times you were there and your understanding of what it's like now?
Do you know, it's essentially, it's a first aid kit. It's a first aid kit. That's essentially what you have. You know, we don't have the proper dressings for burns. You know, we would get children that would come in with 60 to 80% body burns. And if they managed to stay alive long enough, and we would have to change the dressings, you know, we didn't have the appropriate dressing, so it would just be a bandage. When you try to peel off a bandage off a child and you're pulling off the skin and you have no analgesia and you're essentially skinning a child alive every few days to change these bandages to stop an infection, and you're doing that with no painkillers, no analgesia, and they still get an infection, and they still have maggots growing out of their wounds, it's very, very difficult. And then when we are in the ER, when I was there the last time at the Baptist Hospital, there was no ventilators. You know, we had three ventilators for the whole hospital, that including the intensive care unit, not in the emergency department. So, you know, if you have somebody who comes in who's got a severe traumatic brain injury, who's got half their intestines hanging out, you want to put them in a medically induced coma and take them to the operating theater, take them to intensive care, but we don't have a ventilator. So we would sometimes put them in a medically induced coma just for the fact of, just for a bit of dignity for this person. So they weren't experiencing this pain. They weren't looking up and watching half their intestines hanging out, their limbs blown off, and just sat there to bleed out on the floor. And we would put them in a medically induced coma. But because we didn't have ventilators, it would be the family that would be bagging and masking and just blowing air into the lungs. Now, when you have an untrained person doing that, and when you have somebody who has just watched their entire family be killed, and they're watching their child who is in absolute agony, they will panic and they will blow a lot and squeeze and pump a lot. And what actually was happening was mothers were killing their own children because of this. They were blowing so hard and so quickly that they were causing the lungs to explode and collapse. So we had their own family members were killing them. And do you know, I look at this and I just think to myself, how do these people, how do you process that? That, you know, you've managed to somehow pull this child, your child, out of the rubble. You've watched the entire rest of your children be killed. And you bring them to hospital on the back of a donkey cart, carrying them in a blanket. And then you're the one that then kills them. Because we are just so overwhelmed, you know. And you're, and they're on a floor. Sometimes they're outside of the emergency room because they're just, the emergency floor is so full. I mean, that's the reality of every day in Gaza.
I'll tell you a quick story. And get your tell you, tell me where it fits into the context of how you understand the medical system there. So one of our reporters at DropSite, Rasha Abu Jalal from Gaza City, and she had written a piece for us about a month ago about how her family, they were living on a tent on the rubble of the place they used to live in, and they were going to try to stick it out because they had been displaced for 16 months in the past, and it was an absolute nightmare. They did not want to go. They were considering their tent not displacement. They didn't want to go further from that. But then in the last week, there was a shelling, and she looked over, and her daughter's bleeding. Her six-year-old daughter's bleeding. Her face is bleeding. She realizes there's it's not fatal. She's got a cut on her nose. So husband takes her to Shifa Hospital, and the doctor says the description of the hospital, just absolutely dystopian. But when they finally get to in front of a nurse or a doctor, he says, "This is going to need stitches." He's like, "Okay, great." And they're like, "Well, you have to find a pharmacy and find the stitches, find the gauze. And then we'll do it for you."
Yeah.
And then they said, "Okay, this is catastrophic. Like, we cannot stay here." And then at that point, they displaced further south. A 7-hour walk through, again, like an even more dystopian scene. But how does that fit into what you understand about the current state of the hospital system? That, like, they're like, we don't even have the we don't even have the thread to.
I mean, you know, when I was there in Gaza, you know, I would go to the local pharmacies in the area, and I would just buy whatever medicine there was and bring it with me to the hospital. You know, most people can't even afford anyway medicine. Once you say, "Yep, this is what you need some antibiotics," the pharmacy down the road, go pick it up from there. They don't have the money to pay for it because there's no jobs, because everything's been destroyed. And before the war, because of the blockade,
the banks were destroyed.
You can't get money out anywhere.
Yeah.
It's only the money that we bring in as doctors, right? Or sometimes the aid workers that you bring in your own personal money. But even that was restricted. You know, now you're not allowed to bring in more than $200. And you need $150 to leave Gaza because you have to pay for the bus and you have to pay for the visa to get out of Gaza. So, and when you go into Gaza, they open up your bags and they make sure that you're not carrying any medical equipment with you. And if you do, they confiscate it off you. There were doctors that were arrested for bringing in baby formula. You know, we even had trouble with our stethoscopes, whether that was allowed or not. The fact that we were bringing in stethoscopes. So, you know, when we talk about...
What did they tell you was the problem with the stethoscope?
Well, do you know, they're starving 1 million children. You know, obviously for them is they want to make life as difficult as possible because they want as many people as possible to die. You know, the fact that you won't allow children to be evacuated, you won't allow polio vaccines in, you won't allow baby formulas in, you're bombing hospitals and not allowing adequate healthcare workers to come in. You've put a restriction on the amount of healthcare workers come in, the amount of ambulances. There's not a single ICU-equipped ambulance, which is like a ventilator, inside an ambulance. There's not a single one in Gaza. There's not a single MRI machine in Gaza. We're talking about some of the most horrific injuries you've ever seen in any war. And we don't even have the proper equipment. We don't even have proper beds, you know, to wheel them from one place to another. The wheels are broken. The beds, rails are gone. The mattresses of the beds have all been taken because people are displaced and they take these mattresses because they need to, you know, to sleep on. So, you know, you essentially, you know, we're carting around, we're picking up and we're carrying people in the bed because the bed can't move. And we're carrying them and we're taking them to the only functioning CT scanner in the whole north of Gaza. And there's one of them. So, you know, you have a mass casualty event, you have 300 people, you need to do a CT scan for 100, 150 of them. People die on the CT scanner. People die waiting for a CT scanner. I mean, you know, when you go down the list of just the medical problems that we have in Gaza, from the malnutrition, from the fact that, you know, when I was there the first time, 60% of the doctors that I worked with were jaundiced. They had hepatitis A from dirty drinking water. So they would be yellow. And you would think that they were the patients, but they were actually the ones treating the patients. That's how sick they were. And, you know, we're talking about doctors doing 24-hour shifts. We're talking about when they arrive on shift, because most of them are living in tents. When they arrive, that's when we decide what the staffing levels are like for today, because somebody either dies overnight, gets killed, somebody can't make it because, you know, they're being shot at, so they have to hide. People arrive at hospital and they collapse because of the starvation. Whichever way you go, it is a dire situation in Gaza. And, you know, sometimes it's just it's not enough to even, you know, I could talk about this for 6-7 hours and go through every single problem that we have in the hospitals, from lack of resources, lack of medical equipment, from dealing with injuries without having the proper analgesia, anesthetic, from the simple fact of just, you know, when we have mass casualty events, we sometimes just leave people on the floor to die. Because, you know, there's no point in wasting resources. And sometimes you have to be cautious even about the anesthetic and the ketamine that you use. Mm-hmm. You know, ketamine is, it's a sedative, but it's also a painkiller. But it's very quickly reabsorbed. So it only lasts a few minutes. Mm. Now, if we have a mass casualty event and sometimes it takes 24 hours to clear an emergency room, you know, bringing people to theater and bringing them as inpatients and things. If I have somebody with a missing leg or a severed leg and I was to give them ketamine to adequately, you know, analgesize them for that 24-hour period, we would run out of ketamine very quickly in Gaza. So you'd have to just choose to leave these people. Sometimes they're kids. Sometimes you'd have to choose to leave them, even though they've got a leg half missing, with no painkillers for days at a time. And it's cruelty. And sometimes you feel like a butcher when you're there, you know, when you're putting in chest drains into children and you're not sedating them before you do it.
Mm.
You know, a chest drain is stabbing somebody in the chest and getting all the way into where the lung tissue is.
Jeez.
And you're doing that to
through
children.
The chest?
Yeah, through the chest. You go through the side, you go through the chest. And you're essentially stabbing right a hole in them until you see the air start coming out, all the blood. And you're doing that to children with no analgesia or anesthetic. And, you know, that's why it's super important that, like, and again, this is what I mean, is for these politicians, a lot of them see this as, you know, we're doing something here to appease the masses. There is this genocide that's unfolding that the UN have called a genocide. So we'll recognize a Palestinian state, but we don't want to upset the lobby too much, and we don't want to upset the other side too much. Or, you know, so what they do is then that's it. That's enough for us for now. And they don't want to take the next steps, which is sanctions. They don't want to take the next step, which is arms embargo. Mm-hmm. They don't want to take the next step, which is actually trying to help these people.
They won't even kick them out of like the football league, let alone doing any of those things.
And you're in. There are a number of other doctors who've worked in Gaza in town today for a lobbying session on the Hill. I imagine you're working as part of that.
Well, they've asked me to come along. You know,
are you going
to
join them?
Yeah, you know, look, I think I will. It's one of those things. I mean, in the United States now, the situation is so difficult right now in the U.S. that you know, you don't want to be. You don't want to get in too much trouble here, you know, protesting as a foreigner here. So you have to be cautious. But, you know, I'm very much supportive of the Doctors Against Genocide. And I'm very much in contact with a lot of USA doctors here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
it's mostly American doctors who are the Hill today.
They don't have to worry about their, you know, immigration status.
But, you know, the thing is with a lot of these doctors, we have kind of become the flag bearers, doctors here for what's going on in Gaza. You know, journalists aren't allowed in.
Right.
With the humanitarian organizations that are allowed in, like the UN and things like that, they have their spokespeople that are allowed to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it. So, you know, people can't really talk too much. It's the doctors that have the leeway. But if you do speak as a doctor, you have all the risks that come with speaking.
Mm-hmm.
People will go after you online. People will go after you privately. People will come for your medical license. You'll be smeared and you'll try to be silenced.
And they won't let you back in, is my understanding from reporting too. And so then there's fewer people that are able to go in and help.
Well, I'm not allowed back in. Not allowed back in. You know, I applied to go back in July and I was denied.
Right.
Mm. And a big part of that was obviously for me, you know, raising awareness of what was going on. But, you know, this is, again, all part of the plan. You know, you talk, you'll get silenced.
Right.
And the issue that we have right now is, and I can't stress this enough to people, is like we have 1 million children's lives, regardless of even if we were to stop the war today and we were to get an endless supply of aid and doctors in, those 1 million children are forever going to be affected by this. And it will never be the same for them after this again. They will be affected in ways that we will not understand until the next 10, 20 years as these children grow up to see what happens to their development, what happens to their education levels, and also to see what will happen with the backlash from this.
Mm-hmm.
How radicalized do these children become who have watched their mother be executed in front of them, who have watched their mother be run over by bulldozers as they were pregnant carrying their siblings? This has happened in Gaza. Who have held hands with their mother who was waving a white flag and was targeted by a sniper, who's watched their fathers be undressed and in their underwear and tortured in front of them before being executed and thrown into a mass grave. All of these things have happened, and these children have witnessed them in Gaza. Mm-hmm. What are they going to grow up thinking of the world? Mm. And the dehumanization of Palestinians has become so mainstream now. You know, you look at Donald Trump, like, he uses Palestinian as a slur.
Right.
You know, and you see politicians talking about, I hope, you know, they kill all of Gaza or they flatten all of Gaza. There's no innocence in Gaza. They all deserve to die. They're human animals. This dehumanization has become so normalized, and it links in with the Islamophobia, which has become so normalized. You know, the UN assembly meeting, Donald Trump just said, you know, the Europe is going to hell because they're bringing in Sharia law. And, you know, the Islamophobia is so prevalent right now. And I think if you're Muslim or if you're an Arab, you know, you're watching what's going on over the last 20 years, whether it's a million dead Iraqi civilians, whether it's, you know, funding rebels in Syria that have caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, the bombing and sanctions of Yemen, which has caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children as well. And you're watching this throughout the whole Middle East, when you're watching, you know, violence against Muslims in India, and you're watching what's happening to the Rohingya and the Uyghurs. Muslims all over the world are, you know, at the receiving end of these genocides, and the Islamophobia is only just rising and rising, and nothing seems to be getting done. And Gaza seems to be the litmus test here for what governments are going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is relates to my last question for you. You know, as people who obviously cover this a lot, one of the things we hear all the time is, like, why do you care so much about this?
Yeah.
What would be your response as to why?
Yeah.
To focus so much on this genocide in Gaza and what it means, not just for Palestinians, which, of course, the first and foremost concern, but what it does mean for the world.
Well, you know, look, we have, ever since the Second World War, we've said never again. And we had this rules-based order. The rules-based order has been thrown out. You're watching international criminal courts be prosecuted, the UN Special Rapporteur being sanctioned. You're watching how flagrant violations of international law are. You're watching a country bomb and kill world leaders at a whim without any jurisdiction or justification. You're watching as negotiation teams are being targeted and assassinated while you're negotiating for peace. Gaza represents so much because it represents whether might is right. And if might is right, today America might be big, strong, and powerful, but tomorrow it might not be. Mm-hmm. And even within America, you know, there's different minority groups within America, there's different factions within America. You know, you're seeing the attack on things like Jimmy Kimmel when he was cancelled off air, and the censorship that's already begun in this country. Gaza is a litmus test for all of these things, and Gaza is going to be the signaling of, are we going to be a world that follows international rule and order and diplomacy? Or is it going to be okay to genocide a group because they are weaker than you? And that's what Gaza means. And I think people should care about Gaza, because Gaza is not just about this group of Arabs or Muslims or anything like that. This is about how we see it as okay to kill a group of a million children, over half of them are children, to bomb them with 2,000-pound bombs, to put a medieval siege on them. These things we've not seen in this century. And if we allow this to continue and we allow this to happen, then what does it mean for everywhere else around the world? And I think the Global South has united over this issue. And the Global South has not just united over this issue. The Global South is responding with an answer, whether it's BRICS, whether it's these alliances. And look, some of these alliances are not going to be, you know, are not happy alliances. These are sinister alliances with powers that already have terrible human rights records. But this is what we're doing. We're pushing a new world order now where might is right. Mm-hmm. And people now are going to back themselves into a corner. And there's going to be more proliferation of nuclear weapons. There is going to be more attacks, more terrorism spread all around the world because of this Gaza issue. So it is vitally important that we don't just stop and have a ceasefire, but that we bring justice here. Because it's the justice that will fan the flames of calmness throughout the region and throughout the world. But if we allow a million children to be killed and starved to death, and a 2 million population to be displaced, and casinos to be replaced on the bodies and the bones of dead children, that is going to have a psychological effect, not just for the Arab world and the Muslim world, but for the entire global South, because they are going to see this as this is what will happen to us. And, you know, I mean, to go off track a little bit, but, you know, Gaddafi gave up his nuclear program in 2003 and he got killed. The Gulf have given trillions to the United States in what is essentially bribes.
Bribes.
Yeah. And they were bombed by Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's showing is that it doesn't matter. Your money is not going to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Your soft power isn't going to protect you. The only thing in this world that now protects you is might.
Right.
And it's power. And this is why now Saudi have signed a pact with Pakistan,
right.
Nuclear-armed Pakistan, which, you know, is not a democracy. It's not going to have the same safeguards of launching nuclear weapons as, say, the United States right. might do.
Kim Jong-un sitting over there. Nobody's bothering him.
No one's bothering him,
yeah. He's completely mental.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And this is now what we're pushing. We are pushing the world now in this direction where the world is going to become a much more dangerous
place. Kim Jong-un's.
And, you know, with the rise of AI and things like that, we don't know what kind of a world we are stepping into. And this is why it's imperative that it's not just about recognition of Palestine. It's about justice. There's no freedom without justice. There's no liberation without justice. And, you know, I put back to Operation in 2014 when the Israelis when the Israelis bombed Gaza. And they killed almost 3,000 people, including 700 children. You know, part of that ceasefire agreement was that they were to allow Gaza to rebuild. They never did. And it's these injustices that keep adding up that will cause more and more instability. And that's why we need not just a ceasefire, but we need a plan and a roadmap for peace, not just in the Middle East, but for the world as a whole.
Dr. Mel, great to meet you in person. Thank you, as always.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us here.
Hey, if you like that video, hit the like button or leave a comment below. It really helps.
And that was an interview by Breaking Points on the issue of the what's happening in terms of the medical urgencies that were cataloged by the doctor, the good doctor here, who had spent time in Gaza. And actually, he married got married while he was there to one of the nurses that was helping him in the ER. And he can't return now, but he offered a great analysis in this piece. And on the split screen that I'm watching right now is, if you want to tune in, you can tune in to Novara, N-O-V-A-R-A. On YouTube, where they're having a live broadcast right now, and that could disappear anytime. And the live broadcast is basically of what's happening with the flotilla that's heading for Gaza. Right now, so far, two boats have been boarded by the IDF. And one boat, which is the Adara, is managing to report back. And right now, the Avara is being surrounded by a naval ship. A naval ship is circling them, an Israeli naval ship is circling them and shining, you know, bright lights and then disappearing and then shining. It's methods of intimidation that they've used on other flotillas. So you can tune into that and watch what's happening with that, with these 50 boats that are heading to Gaza. The last thing I wanted to mention is that next week on Tuesday, WPFW will be dedicating all of Tuesday, October 7th, to Palestine. And I'll be doing an hour of poetry for Palestine from 11 a.m. until noon. And I've already secured the beautiful bouquet of poets from Washington, D.C., like Kenny Carroll or Sylvana Straw, or from New York and Brooklyn, like Renoua Johari and others. And also, I've secured Sinan Anton, the great author and poet, Iraqi poet who will also be on the show to read some poetry from Mahmoud Darwish or his own poetry. So that's 11 o'clock, 11 a.m. next week on Tuesday on October 7th, as we'll be talking about Palestine all day and doing all kinds of multicultural events all day long dedicated to Palestine. So hopefully you'll tune in then and keep an eye on what's happening in Gaza, and at the same time keep an eye on what's happening with the flotilla as it approaches. It's less than the right now about 80 nautical miles from Gaza. Take care, and we'll see you next Wednesday at 2 p.m.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Noah Portner. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. Here are some headlines. The first federal government shutdown since 2018 began today. During the shutdown, millions of federal employees, including some service members, could go without a paycheck. Hundreds of thousands, including airport security officers, air traffic controllers, and certain members of the military, will be deemed essential workers and told to come to work anyway. ICE agents will also go without pay. National parks could close, and the Smithsonian museums also typically close within a few days. Monthly payments, including retirement, disability, and supplemental security income benefits, will continue during a shutdown, given they are funded by permanent appropriations. There is a deep uncertainty about how long the shutdown could last, given that lawmakers on Capitol Hill don't appear anywhere close to a compromise. Democratic leaders in Congress are demanding an expansion of enhanced Affordable Care Act premium tax credits as part of any government funding deal. The political pressure behind the shutdown remains unresolved, with Schumer and Trump as the two key figures in navigating a compromise. Yesterday, in a vote to fund the government through November, three Democrats broke with Schumer, siding with Republican senators. Angus King of Maine was one of these senators, and he described it as, quote, "one of the most difficult votes I've taken since I've been in the Senate," end quote. Senator King argued that shutting down the government would give Trump more power. Democrat leaders maintain that Trump is not serious about negotiating, and shutting down the government is one of the major cards they have to play. Here is House Minority Leader Jeffries on CNN this morning.
"He's an unserious individual. The Republicans are unserious at this point. They have no interest in having a good faith conversation. And all of the behavior, erratic, unhinged behavior that we've seen subsequent to that White House meeting should suggest to the American people who actually is trying to drive us toward a government shutdown. We continue to say we're willing to have a bipartisan discussion to arrive at a spending agreement that meets the needs of the American people in terms of their health, public safety, and economic well-being, particularly as it relates to driving down the high cost of living, not allowing millions of Americans to experience dramatically increased healthcare premiums, co-pays, and deductibles. That's a reasonable position in defense of the quality of life of the American people."
Leader Jeffries' Republican counterpart, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, also addressed the press in what was almost a mirror argument.
The sad thing about it is that every single bit of this was entirely avoidable. Democrats could have worked with us in a bipartisan manner to avert this unnecessary and very harmful shutdown. But instead, they did something that is rather shocking to us. They prioritized taxpayer-funded benefits for illegal aliens over keeping the government open for American citizens.
As you can hear, Speaker Johnson and Minority Leader Jeffries' arguments are quite similar, namely that the other side refused to act reasonably. Schumer and Trump are still in a position to compromise, if they are so inclined. Hundreds of generals and admirals were summoned from around the world to Quantico, Virginia for a meeting yesterday with Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and President Trump. Hegseth used his time to rally against what he called woke standards and announced a return to, quote, the highest male standard, end quote, for combat positions. President Trump said that U.S. cities should be used as training grounds for the military and that quelling civil disturbances is going to be a major part of the job for those because, quote, it's a war from within, end quote. It's a plan that will likely face opposition in the courts. The Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 was designed to prevent presidents from using armed forces as a domestic police.